You're listening to Central Time. I'm Dean Kinetter, in for Rob Ferret. Now it's time for Food Friday. We're talking about a well-loved classic, sandwiches, and what we can do with them in the summertime. That might mean fresh vegetables, cool wraps, ingredients from your garden or a farmer's market. A Wisconsin sandwich shop manager is with us to talk about all things sandwiches, and we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. What are your favorite summer sandwiches? What ingredients do you like to use in the summer? Maybe that's fresh tomatoes, cucumbers, something else. Do you toast? Do you wrap? What do you think makes for a great sandwich? Give us a call, 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or you can post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Simon Smith is the manager of Crostini Sandwiches in Madison. Simon, welcome to Central Time.
Hey, Dean. Great to be here. How are you doing today?
I'm doing good. How about yourself?
Oh, very well, very well. The sun is shining. We just got through the rain here in Madison.
Beautiful day. Happy to have you with us. Simon, I got to start out by asking, is there something you think makes for a good summertime sandwich?
I think that there are two important things that go into making a really good summer sandwich. I think that the first thing you should think about is kind of like you want it to be a little bit of a lighter sandwich, so it doesn't, you know, weigh you down when the sun's out and you're having a great time playing frisbee with the kids or anything. And then the other thing I think about is kind of like, you know, you want it to be like a little zesty or maybe have like a little bit of bite. So I personally really love doing like a Chipotle or, you know, even just having like a lemon as a garnish that you can throw on top of some guacamole.
Interesting. So something a little light, a little refreshing. What are some of the ingredients we can get in that sandwich to sort of keep it light and cool and crisp?
I think that kind of avoiding beef is good. I like going for like tuna, turkey, or chicken for things if you're going to be doing protein. I really love romaine lettuce. I can't speak enough about romaine lettuce. That's my favorite vegetable of all time. It's pretty basic, but it's got that crunch and that light sweetness that I think is very central to a good summer sandwich.
There are a lot of greens out there, Simon. You've got your romaine, you've got spring mix at the store, you've got spinach, butter lettuce. What is it that really elevates romaine above all those other greens we can find for you?
I think romaine, it really just has that very unique like sweetness to it. I like to call it nature's candy. People consistently talk about raisins being nature's candy, and I will always butt heads with them and go for romaine.
And romaine, it does bring to mind the image of, you know, the TV commercial with the lettuce falling down with water droplets. It does bring to mind that very like summertime sort of vibe.
Exactly.
You also mentioned finding ways to zest up our sandwiches and give them a little bit of a kind of a brighter flavor kick. Lemon and guacamole was one thing I heard. What are some of the other ways you think we can kind of give them a little kick?
You can never go wrong with jalapeno peppers. You can go wrong if you put too many. You don't want to have too much jalapeno. But jalapeno peppers are something that's going to go real well. If you're like a spice fanatic like myself, you could do habanero. There's so many different peppers out there. The kids are getting crazy with those all the time. I think that, you know, you can go for lime juice. Just like, really, that's like something that works with avocado centrally. Zucchini starts with a Z also. Kind of zesty. It's got that crunch that I think like kind of drives home a summer sandwich.
And those peppers, I think even for, you know, balcony gardeners like myself, are kind of a good thing to grow and pick in the summertime. Do you think they're especially good this time of year?
Absolutely. One of my favorite bars in town grows chili peppers and Concord grapes in the back, and I spend way too long back there just eating grapes and having a great time.
We're talking with Simon Smith right now, manager of Crostini Sandwiches in Madison. On this week's edition of Food Friday, we're talking about sandwiches, summer sandwiches in particular. We'd love to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Do you have a favorite sandwich you reach for in the summertime? What do you like to put on your sandwiches that might come from your garden or farmer's market? If you have a favorite sandwich of all time, summer or not, we want to hear about it. 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Simon, you pointed us to a few recipes that you have on the menu there at Christini. One of them is a farmer's market sandwich. What goes on to this one?
So the farmer's market, we started out by sautéing green bell peppers, and then we roast some potatoes right next to those. After that, we have like a house spinach spread that we like to do. It's very simple, just a few ingredients, that spinach, garlic mashed up into the olive oil that we top it with, and Parmesan. That's always just, you know, adds a little bit of lightness and levity to the sandwich. On top of that, we're going to throw a seasonal vegetable medley, which currently in the summertime involves carrots, cauliflower, broccoli, and sugar snap peas. That's right up the summer alley. And then additionally, we got zucchini that we're cutting into small medallions on that sandwich.
Wow. And you mentioned those green peppers and sautéing them. About how long do you sauté them for? Sometimes when I try to put peppers on a sandwich, I find they get a little slidey, maybe a little bit too wet on the sandwich. Any tips for sautéing peppers that go on a sandwich?
I think that it's about high heat and low time. Personally, like that's how we work it, because we just throw them on the flat top grill that we've got, and so it's always running at a really high heat. And by the time that like an egg is ready to flip, because the farmer's market, I like to eat it as a breakfast sandwich and throw a couple eggs on there. Mm. I think that by the time the eggs are ready to flip, that's when I like to pull the peppers.
Sounds delicious. We have a caller with us. We have Lottie in Silver Lake. Hi, Lottie.
Yeah, hey, this is just what I like to put on almost any sandwich. I like potato chips. I prefer original Ruffles potato chips, and top that off with some Catalina salad dressing or French salad dressing, or as far as personal preference, any kind of potato chips or salad dressing. My preference would be Ruffles potato chips and Catalina dressing on top, and that the potato chips offer the crunch, and Catalina offers a little bit of a zingy flavor to it. It works out really well.
And Lottie, do you put that on a sandwich with meat? Is that on PB&J or just about anything?
Just about anything. I like it with meat, like ham sandwich, with that on there. I know you said stay away from beef, but I like beef sandwiches. But just about anything, actually. I don't know. I'd probably stay away from some kind of a tuna thing or whatever. But mostly regular ham sandwiches, or you know, even hot dogs in the summertime. You cut them, slice them down the middle, make a hot dog sandwich or whatever.
Got it. Lottie, thanks for the call at 800-642-1234. Simon, your thoughts on potato chips, or in generally adding a crunch to a sandwich?
Well, that's awesome. It's always great to meet another crunch fanatic, you know, and I totally agree about Ruffles, because I think the ridges are what make a good potato chip.
Nice. And sometimes that crunch can really, especially in the summertime, like we've been talking about with romaine or zucchini, really add a lot to the texture of a sandwich.
I can't believe that I even forgot about potato chips or tortilla chips, because what I like to do is I'll cut a tortilla up and then I'll just throw it in the fryer, and that comes out perfect for like topping a salad or throwing into like a wrap or something like that.
Really? Just a tortilla itself and then fry it up and you got something crunchy?
Exactly. Exactly. If you pull them out at the right time, you can find a nice balance between like very crunchy and a little bit of that like tortilla consistency that's very fluffy.
Something else you've got on the menu is a Chipotle chicken wrap, and wraps are really good for the summertime. Can you tell us a little bit about how this one comes together?
So this one comes together. We start with the tortilla. We've got bacon that we're throwing on the grill, and we're going to throw the chicken on next to it. I still do not know the recipe for the Chipotle mayo that we have. The owner, the chef, really is very secretive about all the condiment recipes. But I know that it's a fantastic Chipotle aioli. I haven't had anything else that pairs with it. I think that is like the single condiment that's kept me working at this place for so long.
Wow. Any other favorite condiments that you like to throw on? I know there's a wide variety out there.
Italian dressing is always good. I like to do that like on top of some coleslaw with some brisket. That's like a personal favorite of mine, is make like a brisket taco. And throw coleslaw on top of there, and then Italian dressing on top of that with a little bit of barbecue sauce and some cheddar cheese. That I like to call that the smokestack. That's something that we have off the menu because I'm really the only one eating that. Other things that I like for dressings, the Cubano sauce is very classic, just like a spicy mustard with like a mayo base and Dijon. Then you throw in whatever hot sauce you got will work for that. Cubano sauce can go on just about anything. I love dipping French fries in there.
Central Time producer Rachel Vasquez just sent us a message. Says mayo, the only condiment you need on sandwiches or in life. So mayo, I know some people love it. Some people can, you know, leave it. Are there ways to kind of dress mayo up, even if we've just got it in the fridge, a way we can kind of elevate it a bit?
Well, if you're feeling like you're missing McDonald's, all you got to do is mix mayo and ketchup and you got Big Mac sauce.
Oh, that's simple, eh?
Mm-hmm. They won't like me saying that, but you know, McDonald's is a big conglomerate, and I say anyone can make their own Big Mac sauce if they got the determination.
Peeling back the curtain this week on Food Friday, we're talking about sandwiches, especially summer sandwiches. Simon Smith, manager of Crostini Sandwiches in Madison, is with us this week. We want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Do you have any tips for elevating basic sandwiches or making a sandwich extra summery? Anything you're picking out of your garden or your local farmer's market that you like to put on a sandwich? And hey, if you've got a favorite sandwich of all time, summer or otherwise, let us know about it. 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@wpr.org. We'll continue the conversation and hear from you coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Dean Kinetter. Right now, we're picking up our talk about summertime sandwiches with Simon Smith, manager of Crostini Sandwiches in Madison. And we're taking your calls about your favorite sandwiches, your favorite things to put on sandwiches during the summertime. The number is 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's go to the phones now. We have Laura with us in Madison. Laura, hi.
Hi.
What's your recommendation?
Hi. One of my family's favorite summertime sandwiches is grilled mahi-mahi with a quick pickled onion on a ciabatta roll.
Wow. And anything else you like to put on that, Laura, or just those three and you're set?
We put a little rub on the mahi-mahi, so it's a little spicy. So it's got that kick that you were talking about earlier. And it's very light. And I think one thing I'd like to say is the bread really matters.
Sounds delicious. Laura, thanks for the call. Simon, what do you think about some fish on a sandwich and that ciabatta bread?
That sounds fantastic. And talk about like ciabatta with mahi-mahi. I feel like those two textures would just align very perfectly. Very perfectly. That's a great sandwich. I'm going to have to bring that back to the restaurant.
And that softer ciabatta bread with kind of a softer protein there, the mahi-mahi, is that a good idea to sort of, you know, match the softer inside, the softer outside of the sandwich in general?
I think that that's something you can really play around with, but it makes it just like a very easy to eat sandwich, you know, something that like, you can have and not really have to worry too much about putting in a lot of work. I've had sandwiches on like very hard baguettes a few times, and you kind of like, it feels like you're like a lion in like a nature documentary kind of, you know? And I enjoy not having to put in a lot of work to eat my food.
Absolutely. Let's go next to Jimbo in Plover. Jimbo, hello.
No, hey, how's it going, guys?
Good. What's
hey,
on your
Jimbo?
Mind?
Hey, up in Plover here, but so I learned this from my nephews. You crush up Doritos. You put Cool Ranch, spicy Doritos in your sandwich, and the other thing is mayonnaise and peanut butter. But you got to put them on both sides of the sandwich, not together. And I'll listen to you guys talk. Take it easy, guys.
Thanks, Jimbo, for the call. That might be a hot take there, Simon. What do you think?
Man, now I'm just thinking about what about if you put Doritos and Cool Ranch Doritos on a mayo and peanut butter sandwich?
The possibilities are truly becoming endless here this week.
Absolutely.
Let's go next to Ken calling us from Wausau today. Hi, Ken.
Good morning. I guess it's afternoon. I'm calling because I think perhaps the most important piece of a sandwich is the bread. And someone just mentioned ciabatta a little bit, but there's nothing better than the bread. In fact, toasted bread with butter is a great sandwich. But if you're starting to think about sourdough bread or Irish soda bread, those are great. So it doesn't matter what you put in the side. Those are great.
Got it. Ken, thanks for the call. And Simon, we haven't dived too deep into the bread yet. What kind of breads are your favorites to work with at Christini?
We use just Italian white bread, which is kind of like the bigger loaves for every single panini. I'm a huge fan of brioche buns for doing sandwiches, kind of like, you know, like a chicken filet sandwich. I think brioche is like almost always my go-to when it comes to that. I'm always looking for the word brioche if I'm ordering a burger anywhere. Other than that, like sourdough is amazing. A whole wheat is surprisingly in addition to being healthy for you, it lends a lot of texture. You get those oats on the sides. Sometimes you'll find like a nut. I love maple nut is the bread that I keep stacked at my house all the time when I want to make like a peanut butter banana sandwich.
Maple nut. I imagine that adds a little bit of sweetness to that peanut butter banana too.
Absolutely. You know, just a little bit of the kicker that you need so you don't have to put too much honey on there.
Honey, I was just going to recommend that. I'm a big fan of the PB and banana myself, and that honey is really where it's at.
Mm-hmm.
Ken, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. Still time if you have any sandwich recommendations, questions about sandwiches, 800-642-1234. Ken also mentioned toasting bread, really elevating it. I second that, Ken. I think that's a great idea. And I know that you do that with the paninis where you're at, Simon.
Yeah, everything is pressed on a panini press for that, and all of the sub sandwiches we make, we offer them toasted or not toasted. Personally, I think it's a little bit the same line as when someone gets pasta. This is a little off topic, but we offer either French bread or garlic bread. I think that you should always go for the garlic bread, in my opinion. So, like, having an untoasted sub sandwich, I feel like you should almost always have it toasted, unless there's the one exception, which I think in an Italian sub, you should never toast an Italian sub because you want to have that like softer bread feel.
And for those of us in the home setting who may not have a panini press, but still like, you know, good toasted sandwich, is there a best way to go about it? Is it toaster, oven, broiler? What tips do you have?
So I would recommend just putting it into on an oiled skillet. And it's funny, but if you have like kind of just like a flat piece of metal, like a little piece of sheet metal or something that's heat resistant, you know, that'll also like collect heat, something that, you know, won't get damaged or burnt. All you got to do then is if you have like kettlebells or something heavy, you can put it on top of that and it works like a panini press at your house.
Interesting. So in the skillet, they're taking a little bit of like the grilled cheese model and bringing it over to other sandwiches.
Exactly. Just doing it like that. And if you're ever cooking burgers or like a grilled cheese, throw a pot lid over it on the pan. And that way all the heat kind of conducts around it. It'll melt everything evenly.
Huh. Interesting. Yeah. The timing of melting the cheese on a burger has always kind of been challenging for me. So I'm going to give that a try next time. We are going to go next to Jared in Stoughton. Hey, Jared.
Well, hello there. So I have a sandwich that I grew up eating. We didn't have a lot of money, so you kind of made do, and I am definitely a Miracle Whip guy. So I would take white bread, and you lightly toast it, barely brown. Miracle Whip on both sides, and then you stack 1.5 to 2 inches of crispy iceberg lettuce in the middle, and you get that tang from the Miracle Whip, and you get all that crunch from the salad and the lettuce. It's so good.
Jared, thanks for the call. Simon, sometimes simple can be just what we need.
Absolutely. At night, I'm a bartender, and three ingredient recipes are my favorite. I think that is true with sandwiches as well. Jared, I'm going to have to try that the next time I go grocery shopping. Got to pick up some iceberg.
Nice. Jared, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. We'll go next to Suzanne driving on I-90. Hi, Suzanne.
Hi. So my husband is from England, and he makes something called saucy sandwiches, and it is just Worcestershire sauce on bread.
That's it, huh? Anything else on there?
Nope, it's just that.
And have you tried this, Suzanne? Do you back your husband's recipe?
No, I refuse.
Got it. Suzanne, thanks for letting us know about that. Simon, if we're not using Worcester sauce by itself, is there anything else we can put it on that can really work?
Most of the experience I have with Worcestershire is using it in, I think it's used in hollandaise, so I'll just dip asparagus in something that has it.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. That's good stuff.
I should say one thing. Mm-hmm. Suzanne, I hope you have a lovely marriage, and don't let that sandwich get in between you. Just make sure that you're not watching him eat it.
That's right. We don't need sandwiches coming in between anything here. Simon, before we run out of time, I want to talk about the cran apple turkey chutney panini that you told us about. Tell us about what goes into this one and why it's so tasty.
So this one, we're going to start it out with thinly sliced turkey, and we've got a house cranberry apple chutney, which is just we slow cook those together and add a little, like a very slight amount of sugar. The cranberry, you need to add the sugar to balance out the cranberry. And then that just, it's a very simple sandwich. It's a panini, and we've got provolone spinach spread. I already talked about the spinach spread. It's got garlic, olive oil, and Parmesan. And then we throw some onions on there. Not green onions. It's got white onions. So it just kind of has like a very like spring, summery kind of like lights up your mouth, like kind of like, you know, a bunch of flavors popping all over the place.
Wow, that sounds really good. Nice and tart. And, you know, we haven't even talked about cheese. There's a lot to get into. But Simon, it's been a lot of fun. Thank you for joining us today. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Dean. Have a great day.
You too. That was Simon Smith, manager of Christini Sandwiches in Madison. He talked with us on this week's edition of Food Friday, all about great sandwiches for the summertime. And if you have any more recommendations, you can keep letting us know over on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Coming up Monday on The Morning Show with Kate Archer Kent, the vinyl resurgence. Record shops are seeing demand for vinyl at its highest point in years. We'll hear from two Wisconsin guests about what's behind the trend, and we'll want to hear about your favorite record finds. Plus, the head of the state broadband task force talks about the progress they're making on bringing high-speed internet to more Wisconsinites. That and more coming up Monday after 7 on The Morning Show. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Dean Kinetter in for Rob Ferret. More than 4 months after Russia first invaded Ukraine at the end of February, the war is still grinding forward. Some of Russia's latest strikes have targeted cities in southern and central Ukraine, the latest being the southern city of Mykolaiv, where, according to local officials and reported by the New York Times, Russian missiles hit two universities, a hotel, and a mall. Here's Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky in a video address posted to his website yesterday. He started the address saying he's speaking not to Ukrainians, but to the country's democratic partners. He demands Russia be officially declared a terrorist state.
Жодна інша держава світу не дозволяє собі щоденно знищувати крилатими ракетами і реактивною артилерією мирні міста і звичайне людське життя.
Translating here, no other state in the world, he said, allows itself to destroy peaceful cities and ordinary human life with cruise missiles and rocket artillery every day. We're going to be talking about the state of the war in Ukraine, how effective Western support has been, and whether it can hold out much longer. And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about where things stand with the war? Do you think the U.S. and its allies have done enough to help Ukraine and to punish Russia? What more would you like to see them do, if anything? And what questions do you have about the wartime goals of Russia, Ukraine, and the situation on the ground right now? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Lowell Barrington is an associate professor in the Department of Political Science at Marquette University. He's also a research affiliate with UW-Madison's Center for Russia, East Europe, and Central Asia. Lowell, welcome back to Central Time.
Hi, Dean. It's great to be back on.
Good to have you. As I mentioned in the intro, some recent Russian attacks in central and southern Ukraine. Where is the majority of fighting happening right now?
Well, we're 4.5 months into the war, and as you might remember, the initial assault that was really in a few different places but had focused on Kyiv and went very badly for Russia, has led them to focus initially more on the south and southeast, and then most recently really in the far east of Ukraine, in the areas of Luhansk and Donetsk, what's known as the Donbass region. And that had been going better for them, certainly than some of the earlier parts of the conflict. But it is interesting to see these missile strikes, especially really over the last month, where they have been hitting areas that are far from the central areas of fighting right now for them, including the attack earlier this week in Vinnytsia. That's actually in kind of west central Ukraine. It was a pretty long strike away from where the fighting is mostly going on right now.
And what do you attribute that to, those attacks in more civilian areas?
Well, this isn't new. Russia has been hitting areas that have been civilian targets, at least according to the Ukraine and the West, for much of the war. But there were times when they would do that and times when they'd back off. And one theory about it not happening for a while was they were actually running low on the kinds of precision missiles they were trying to use. But in the last month or so, seem to have done that more frequently. So that's one possibility. The other is that Ukraine has had some success in the last week or two, in particular, thanks to some of the new weapons they're using from the United States and Europe in the east. And this may be something where Russia is also sort of lashing out a bit in terms of things not going quite as well in the east in the last week.
In that far eastern part of Ukraine, is there much territory changing hands right now between Russia and Ukraine?
The changes are not real swift right now. Russia had been making kind of incremental gains in a few key cities and things, for example, up to a week or so ago. Ukraine has had some success actually in the southern part of the country, and in the area around Kherson, for example. They have actually pushed Russia out of a number of settlements or smaller towns and things in that area. So they've had some successes there, but it is largely been kind of a bit of a stalemate for the last week or so in the east, at least.
We're talking with Lowell Barrington right now, associate professor of political science at Marquette University, an expert on Eastern Europe and Russia, talking about the latest in the war in Ukraine. We're also taking your calls at 800-642-1234. Let's go to the phones now. We have Nick with us in La Crosse. Hi, Nick.
Hello.
What was on your mind?
When this war started, and it was evident that the Ukrainians were going to fight and the Russians were in trouble, we sort of given them, if we weren't going to provide troops, which was off the table, we sort of provided them heavy arms right from the beginning. And I wrote a letter to the La Crosse Tribune that was published stating that the West was going to have blood on their hands. And they have a lot of blood on their hands because they never acted forcefully from the beginning.
Nick, thanks for the call. Lowell, what do we know about the support that the U.S. has given Ukraine militarily up to this point and right now?
Well, Nick's point is an interesting one, and I will agree to a certain extent in that we had not focused initially in our aid packages on some of the heavy artillery and some of the newer, higher tech heavy artillery that they are now receiving. But some of that had to do the way that the Russians were fighting. That was not a central priority in some ways for the Ukrainians. They were much better off early on using many of the things that we had supplied them, including the Javelin anti-tank weapons that they were very successful with early on, the Stinger anti-helicopter things, some of the drone things that they've been using that we've supplied them. And I think it's also important to say, we gave them a lot of the really nuts and bolts basics of artillery rounds and, millions of rounds of small ammunition, tens of thousands of body armor and helmets, and, things that they really needed early on as well. But one of the other challenges, the bigger and the kind of more powerful the equipment, the longer it takes to get it there and the harder it is to transport it to where Ukraine needs it in the battlefield. So some of this has been a timing issue. The new HIMARS systems, which have been really effective, they are mobile, but you also, when you get them into the country, initially some of these larger things can be a bit more visible, and there was a fear that, again, Russia might be targeting these more effectively, some of these bigger, heavy artillery systems. So that was slowing down things as well a bit. So I think it's fair to say we didn't give them heavy arms early on, but it would be a mistake to jump from that to the idea that we have not been providing a lot of support.
And has that support made a measurable effect on the battlefield, do you think?
Well, it's made a huge effect, again, early on in the initial attack on Kyiv, for example. The Ukrainians were really successful with attacking the lines and sort of columns of tanks and other vehicles and things that the Russians were using. The losses by Russia of tanks alone, I mean, not to mention the soldiers, which is another really just amazing number and kind of tragic thing for Russia right now. But, I mean, the estimates are that Russia's lost about 1,500 tanks so far. Ukraine has captured a lot of these and been able to use them. So one of the strange statistics, they have a whole part of their military, for example, that is essentially a bunch of mechanics that fix up these Russian tanks and send them back out for the Ukrainians to use. And one of the interesting statistics is that Ukraine actually has more tanks now than it did at the start of the army, start of the war. Sorry, this army has, you know, seized so many tanks and things that it's got more tanks than they had at the beginning. And there was a joke going around about one of the things that's been happening is that farmers have actually been capturing some of these tanks that have been damaged or abandoned. And, you know, you see these videos of Ukrainian farmers are dragging these tanks down the road with their tractors. And the joke was that Ukrainian farmers had become the fifth largest army in the world. And that's not true. But if you had the sort of took the number of tanks they'd captured, it was something like the 35th largest army in terms of tanks, you know, just that Ukrainian farmers had captured. So, again, I think they've had a lot of successes. And the part of the war we're in now has been more challenging. This is where Russia has turned toward just a real use of constant artillery bombardment, you know, again, not being very discriminating between civilians and military targets. And that has required Ukraine to try to switch to some of these more long-range and larger artillery attack systems.
What do we know about Vladimir Putin's goals at this point, how they may have changed, and what he could see as an acceptable outcome?
Well, boy, that's the tough question. I mean, I can say certainly his approach changed in the sense that early on they really thought they could get the capital, Kyiv, in relatively short order. I think there's a pretty good understanding that the thought on the Russian side was it might be a week or 2 weeks and they would have control of Kyiv, and that clearly did not happen. So at that point, there seemed to be two ways that Putin's focus changed. One was to make sure they got control of as much of the south, and in particular the Black Sea coast, as possible. And then the other thing was to now then move the fighting back into the Far East, which had been an area of fighting, obviously, ongoing since 2014 on and off. This is not a brand new war there. But Russia has really focused its attention on the east and again, has succeeded, for example, in largely getting full control of the entire region of Luhansk right now through some of its successes in the last few weeks.
We're talking with Lowell Barrington, associate professor in the Department of Political Science at Marquette University, affiliate with UW-Madison Center for Russia, East Europe, and Central Asia. We're talking about the latest in the war on Ukraine, and we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Have you continued to follow updates out of Ukraine? Have you had difficulty following the ongoing war as it's faded a bit in the news? What questions do you have about U.S. and Western support? Is it something you'd like to see continue and the U.S. continue to stand behind financially, militarily? Where do you think the war is going? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Dean Kinetter. We continue our talk with Marquette University's Lowell Barrington. We're looking at the effectiveness and endurance of Western support for Ukraine in its war against the Russian invasion. And we're taking your calls at 800-642-1234. If you have thoughts about how the war is going, questions about what it will take to reach a conclusion, call us at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Lowell, just in the last week, British Prime Minister Boris Johnson resigned, and he was an early and a very staunch advocate for backing Ukraine militarily, financially. What impact do you think his resignation could have on support from the West?
That's a really important question. I think the real short answer is, so far it looks like the support from the UK is going to continue, even as a replacement Prime Minister comes into position in the UK. But I don't want to downplay his role. He and President Biden actually both should receive much more credit, I think, than they both have in really leading this very united Western stance against Russia in this conflict, and you know, getting the UK and Germany and France together on, you know, on the same page on things is not always easy. And Johnson, you're right, was very forceful. He traveled to Kyiv multiple times, and even to the point where there are towns in Ukraine that have been discussing changing street names to name them for Boris Johnson. I mean, this is something where in Ukraine he's an incredibly popular figure because of how, again, as you said, early and strong his support for Ukraine was. But again, I think even some of the leading figures that are looking to be kind of potential contenders, at least to take over for Johnson, include Liz Truss, who's the foreign secretary, and Ben Wallace, who's the defense secretary. And both of them have been, you know, again, very vocal and very strong in their support of Ukraine against Russia. So I think in the grand scheme of things, it won't change a lot. But Ukraine and President Zelensky in particular were certainly not happy to see Boris Johnson's resignation announcement.
We'll go next to the phones. We have Glenn with us on I-94 right now. Hi, Glenn.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What did you want to bring up?
Well, I only wanted to comment, frankly, on the query that you put out to the listeners as to how we feel regarding the U.S. support for the war, quote unquote, in Ukraine. And I'm 100% behind not only the financial, but the weaponry that they need now at this juncture in the war, because it's, you know, it's changed. It's changed so much from when it was in Kyiv to where it is now. And that's what they really need, the HIMARS systems and the weaponry that actually goes along with that. Because it's not just one piece of equipment. It's a multiple set, you know. It's something that I was just listening to the section on Boris Johnson as well. I think if Wallace, the UK defense secretary, takes that job, I don't think the position will be a lot worse. And I understand Zelensky's disappointment in Johnson's resignation. I really do. But it isn't always from the top. It's got to be a unified front.
Got it. Glenn, thank you so much for the call. Lowell, looking at U.S. military support, this war could still go on for a while. Do we have a sense of how long U.S. support could last, could be there?
So far, the commitment from the United States has been strong. It continues to be strong, and I don't expect that to waver. I think it's one of the things that the Biden administration can point to as some real successes of getting Ukraine these weapons that they've been able to use. And certainly the Ukrainian military has outperformed what a lot of people were expecting at the beginning of the war. And I think the support from the United States and Europe is a part of that. Glenn's comment, by the way, about the HIMARS system is interesting. This is a really important relatively new weapon system, at least for Ukraine, to have. The acronym is for High Mobility Artillery Rocket Systems. So these are precision and longer range. They use GPS to guide these rockets that are going in. And Ukraine's used them quite effectively. The point, though, that they still don't have a lot of these is correct, at least in terms of what they want. They've got around 12 systems, I believe, that at least are in the process of being delivered. A few of them they've been using already now. But to actually have equal footing with Russia to be able to just do whatever they wanted to against the Russians, you might need as many as 60 to 100 of those systems in place. And you know, we're not on pace to get them those. So, you know, it's certainly always more could be done. But again, I think we want to keep in mind the commitments so far from the United States of $7 billion in support, you know, since February alone.
Thanks for that call, Glenn. Let's go next to Mary Kay in Kenosha. Hi, Mary Kay.
Hi, I would like to see more diplomacy, like some of our news in Russia. Also, peace talks with Putin from NATO. And we have to keep helping Ukraine, whether with Doctors Without Borders and militarily. And to show Putin that if he opens up his border for trade and education and things, it's going to be way better than what he's doing to these people.
Mary Kay, thanks for the call. Lowell, what do you think about the prospect for more peace talks?
Well, I am always a supporter of diplomacy over fighting if it can work. There have been some talks, and there are actually some pretty interesting and important talks that started and then fell apart a bit. But on just something that sounds kind of basic, but in Russia and Ukraine trying to work together to get the grain in Ukraine out to the world. You know, we're facing this grain shortage and food crisis in parts of the world, partly because of this war. And Ukraine right now has around 22 million metric tons of grain that is stuck in silos and storage facilities because it can't get it out through the ports and things that it used to be able to use. So even something like that, if there can be an agreement between Ukraine and Russia, right, that those kinds of agreements can sometimes start the ball rolling toward bigger agreements. But getting to a negotiated settlement at the end of the war is really hard at this point. The centrality of identity in this war, you know, that this has been as much about identity as it has been about economics and even territory. And so, you know, Putin really feels like he needs a big victory at this point, and I think Zelensky can't be seen as sort of surrendering territory. So we're still at a place where finding that solution is hard through diplomacy. I think there is a territorial solution down the road that they may get to at some point, but I think, unfortunately, we are quite a ways from that, and we're looking at a minimum of months more of this conflict.
We heard from Tim in St. Germain, who couldn't stay on the line but asked if Lowell, you think this could end in a division of territory like North Korea and South Korea. We, of course, had the invasion of Crimea in 2014. Is it possible that something like that could, there could be a division of territory that Tim is thinking about?
I mean, we've de facto had that a bit since 2014 in the sense of the areas in the far eastern parts of Ukraine that what were called the separatists, but with a lot of Russian help, had been controlling that territory de facto, and Crimea has essentially been incorporated into Russia now as a territorial unit. I think what's more likely is, and it would be hard for Ukraine to accept this, but I mean that there will in fact be some sort of territorial concession in the east that at a minimum would include something like Luhansk and Donetsk entirely, maybe with a special status where they're not part of Russia. I think Russia will act to try to actually make them part of Russian territory. What's interesting about that, though, is for Ukraine long term, while it's devastating in terms of Ukrainian identity and it will be seen as something that's really politically very difficult for Zelensky to do, they will be more united and more European-looking and more Western-looking if Russia grabs those regions than if Russia were to leave them in Ukraine. And so I think that one of the interesting things to look at is if we think real long-term, as hard as it will be for Ukraine to want to accept this, that Ukraine itself, the population and the where the territory is, where there's kind of the most and least pro-Russian support, the loss of Donetsk and Luhansk would actually make Ukraine more united and more pro-Western and potentially even accelerate things, you know, like EU and NATO membership.
And Lowell, in our last minute, what is the factor that you have your eye on in the coming months?
I think whether the U.S. can and Europe can continue to get Ukraine more and more of these large weapon systems that can do a lot more damage, the damage we've started to see in the last few weeks. Ukraine has hit a number of storage facilities and command centers with some of these new weapons, still in Ukraine, but doing a lot of damage to the Russian effort and slowing them down. And so I think that's one thing to keep an eye on. The other thing, you know, that people have talked about a bit, but is Putin's role in all this in terms of what, you know, maybe he does decide at some point that he's got enough of a victory. Maybe he does start pushing for more talks and things like that. I don't see that immediate. He hasn't indicated that as a likely thing in the near term. But at some point, he may decide that as his military still becomes, you know, more and more fatigued, even with this new focus on the east, that it would be time for talks. So we can perhaps at least hope that could happen.
Lowell, thanks as always for joining us.
And thank you.
Lowell Barrington is an associate professor of political science at Marquette University. He was with us to talk about the latest in the war on Ukraine. Coming up Monday on Central Time, the first woman to hike all 11 National Scenic Trails just finished up her goal in Wisconsin. We'll talk with her about her time on the Ice Age Trail and what's next. Plus, a new study on ice cover going down in the Great Lakes over the last several years. We'll look at the data and why it matters. That's Monday on Central Time.